Hello, this is Aaron, and welcome back to the podcast. Today's podcast is sponsored by New St. Andrews College. Today's culture shifts like sand, but New St. Andrews College is established on Christ, the immovable rock. The college is a premier institution that forges evangelical leaders who don't fear or hate the world. Guided by God's word, equipped with the genius of classical liberal arts and God-honoring wisdom, with a faculty dedicated to academic rigor and to God's kingdom, New St. Andrews College offers an education that frees people. To find out more, visit nsa.edu. That's nsa.edu. Well, welcome back. I am going to be audio only on the podcast for a while. I will be restoring video, but I've moved, as I said, and don't fully have my office set up correctly to be able to do podcasting, but hopefully it won't take too terribly long to do that. Speaking of moving, today I wanted to highlight something about the nature of our divided society that's actually based a little bit on the town that I moved to and some political dynamics that I saw here. We are used to thinking about polarization and division through lenses such as race or through political polarization, but I want to try to talk about this in terms of class by taking those other two things off the table. Now, obviously, that's not completely possible to do, but what I want to try to do today is focus a little bit on the changes in our society in the last 30 or so years that have opened a divide between the white middle and lower middle class, working class, and the white upper middle class. Now, I am not the first person who's talked about this. It's something that has been discussed actually for about 30 years. For those of you who are in my member program, we're doing a course this year called The Conditions of Modernity, and in the February class, we're going to be talking about the early 90s populist literature, and this was a theme from the early 90s populist literature, and we'll be reading some of that and sampling it. We also see something similar in the work of Charles Murray in his book Coming Apart, which I believe came out in 2012, or Robert Putnam. He wrote Bowling Alone. He also wrote a book called Our Kids that's very good, talking about the same topic. And what has happened is that if you go back to the 80s, and even dial it back maybe to the pre-war era, but certainly back to World War II, we essentially had a single mass consumer culture. And prior to that, we probably had regional cultures, as we didn't really have a national media quite so much, didn't really have as nationalized an economy, so things were very much more regionally autonomous, perhaps. But certainly what we think of as America, which for, you know, the baby boomers and even the silents, their experience was a mass consumer culture of the 50s, 60s, 70s, and even into the 80s. And really in the 1990s, the mass consumer culture started to fragment for a variety of reasons. And one of the implications of the mass consumer culture is that the folkways of all Americans were more or less the same. We ate the same foods. We drank the same coffee. We watched the same TV shows, etc. We drove the same cars. Now, of course, there were nicer cars and not so nice cars. You know, there were somewhat nicer foods, but fundamentally, it was basically the same lifestyle. And since you know I have written about the old WASP upper class, yes, they had unique folk ways and ways of living, but the WASP were truly upper class. They were people who were a tiny percentage of the population, a very small group. And one of the things that made them unique is that they were small enough to basically kind of know each other. The upper class people in a particular community, like say here in Indianapolis, they would have all known each other. They would have grown up together. Whereas today, what we're really talking about is the upper middle class, which is the top 10 to 20% of the population, which is an enormous share. And it's not a group of people who, by and large, know each other. It's a group of people who do share various outlooks on life in common, both ideological, political, but also in terms of their folkways. And what has happened is, since, I'm going to say 1990, it probably started in the 80s, maybe even before that. Things usually start way earlier than we think. With the rise of education, there's deindustrialization, rise of the service economy, technology. there was a sort of a bifurcation in society in which the upper middle class, the most educated, affluent, professional people, it's not totally about money, it's also a state of mind, but money has a lot to do with it, education has a lot to do with it, started to diverge and created essentially their own culture. And they now today live very different lives than the rest of the country. And this has produced splits and helps us explain various of the dynamics that are going on in our country. So I moved to a suburb of Indianapolis called Carmel. Carmel has about 100,000 people. It's sort of an upscale business suburb, but it's not all brand new. I mean, again, 40% of it existed prior to 1990. And in this mass consumer age, the pre-1990 and probably from a Carmel perspective, pre-2000 environment, there really wasn't this mass distinction between the upper middle class and the middle class. And so Carmel probably had many of both. One of the things that was a product of this era was that more affluent people geographically lived in many of the same communities as less affluent people. Now, maybe they didn't live in the exact same subdivision, but you didn't have this tremendous geographic separation of people into essentially very upscale enclaves and essentially everybody else kind of enclaves. You know, people who made a good living often lived on the nice street in the same town as everyone else. Today, they're much more likely to be living in a town that's just for affluent people or which is just a town that is like an exclusive neighborhood in a big city or something like that. But you go back to this era and it was kind of a mixture of people and there were a lot of middle-class people in these communities and they shared certain basic outlooks on life. And one of them is what I call the classic Republican suburban mindset, which is low taxes, over everything. Now you could say good schools, but ultimately we're going to focus on the taxes because these people have tended to be very much focused on low taxes. If you ask why move to the suburbs anywhere, one of the things they're always going to tell you is, well, the taxes are lower. Now that's not always true anywhere today. So we will, you know, maybe we can talk about that a little bit. But fundamentally, the idea is you go out to the suburbs, everything's brand new and things are just cheaper out there in terms of taxes. And these people have tended to be pretty hostile to what they think of as big government. They don't want a lot of government spending, and they don't want a lot of heavy-handed regulation. So they tended to just take whatever sprawl was being built. They liked it because it was, basically the thing that was popular at the moment. So it's like, well, we're building the stuff that people like now, and so that's pretty good. And they tended to take it. And they also, though, were often, you know, skeptical of development. So, you know, the developer would come in, a bunch of people would complain, but then it would ultimately get approved. This group of people had a sort of NIMBY mindset. I got out of the city. I moved out here to the country, of course, being a suburb. And wow, I don't want the city following me out here. There's an old quip that sprawl is the next house built in the suburbs after mine. And so there was always a sort of NIMBY streak there, particularly in the baby boomers, who really populated a lot of the suburbia. I think of NIMBYism, which stands for not in my backyard. It's basically sort of an anti-development mindset. People who don't want any change, people who want to keep things the way they are. I think of that as, you know, heavily generational baby boomer. Of course, there are people of any generation that have that point of view, but it's really something that came to the fore, I think, with the boomers. And so you kind of had this kind of middle class mindset of vaguely anti-development, but it really more slowed things down than stopped it. What it did do was ensure that everything that was built was pretty much just the standard stuff that everybody else was building. And it was very low tax motivated, didn't want the government to spend a lot of money. And then what we see with that is, you know, the upper middle class kind of shared that view. So people who would have been the corporate executives sort of bought into that same basic pattern of here's what suburbia should be, because again, they were common folkways. Now, what we saw in the post-1990s world is that these folkways began to diverge. And people in this top 20% began to demand many, many more consumption amenities. They started drinking nice coffee. You know, first was Starbucks, with now with the little independent coffee roasters. That would not have been true in the 80s, when it's like, were you a Folgers guy or a Maxwell House guy? Similarly, people started going for, you know, microbrew beers and their IPAs, whereas in the 80s, your premium beer, if you wanted to be a premium beer guy, was Heineken, right? So people began to have farm-to-table restaurants, they started going to farmers markets, and this affected the city, obviously, but also affected the suburbs, as people in these upscale milieus, the upper middle class, began to demand more consumption amenities. Now, the middle class did this to some extent as well, but not on the same track. So there was a divergence between the upper middle class and the middle class in terms of the type of life that they live, their folkways, as I would say. What kinds of things do they buy? What kinds of shows do they watch? What kind of coffee do they drink? What kinds of foods do they eat? Things became very, very different. And they also began to geographically sort. And in part, that's because they no longer agree on a definition of the good life. And therefore, it becomes impossible for them to live together harmoniously in a particular community. There's a lot of writing today about housing, restrictive housing policies and zoning policies that limit the ability to build, and why housing prices are getting more expensive, etc. What I want to hone in on here is why this essentially divergence in folkways and preferred modes of living really lend themselves towards some type of exclusionary housing policy, just because of this inability for people to share a common definition of the good life. So, as I said, the upper middle class began to pursue higher consumption amenities. And one of the things that we see is that they began to demand nicer communities and higher grades of public services, where the traditional middle class would have said, we don't want the government to spend any money, we want it to do the basics. The upper middle class is now much more demanding. They're like, hey, we want world-class parks. We want nice public amenities in our town, and we're willing to spend money to get them, meaning we're willing to tax ourselves to get them. Whereas the middle class is still in this more retro mode, they tend to be very hostile towards that kind of spending. And so what we see today is, as communities try to build amenities in their community, there's often great divisions, as the middle class residents are very, very opposed to this, and the more upper middle class residents, and often the civic leaders, support it. And this happens a lot, especially in more middle-class communities. And again, there is an ideological element to this. So there's a local talk radio show here named host here, Rob Kendall. He's very libertarian. He lives out in Brownsburg, which is a sort of a middle-class suburb in the western suburbs of Indianapolis. His town wants to build a pool. Anytime they want to build anything, he opposes it because he thinks it's too much spending. Now, there's certainly an ideological component to that. He's kind of a libertarian guy. He's got that kind of libertarian bent. But also, there's a class element as well. Doesn't mean he's a bad guy by any means, but that's just the kind of community he wants to live in. One where there's very, very limited public spending, and the public sector plays a sort of minimal role. And so, if you are someone who is in the upper middle class by income or by inclination, and you want to have these high consumption amenities, then frankly, what you don't want is Rob Kendall type people moving into your community. You do not want a community that attracts a lot of middle class people. And I'm not even talking about, the lower middle class or getting down to the spectrum. I'm just talking about basic middle class people. Remember, I think even among white people, the median person does not have a college degree, right? Only a minority of people in the country have college degrees. In fact, even among the most educated younger cohorts, only one state has even half of their adult population with college degrees, and that's Massachusetts. And they're barely at 50% among millennials. So the average person, even in suburbia, is not having a degree, and they tend to have, you know, their incomes are lower, so they're more cost sensitive, their folkways are different. And if you're someone who's one of these more upper middle class trending communities, do you really want a lot of very affordable housing that allows people like that to move into your town? Probably not, because they are going to be people who are rabidly, militantly hostile to the kinds of things that you want. They just have a totally different vision of what the community is going to be. So we see this playing out in Carmel. We've had a mayor here. I wrote about him, Jim Brainerd. He's been the mayor for like 7 terms, I think. He's not running for re-election. And now there's an election. And 2 members of the city council who are sort of aligned with his way of thinking are running. And then this other person by the name of Fred Glynn, who was Brainerd's opponent in the last election, is also running. And basically, he is essentially the anti-Brainerd. His view is, we don't want to spend money. We have to fiscally retrench. We have to stop having the government involved in development and essentially let the market just dictate everything. He doesn't even really like the roundabouts that people put in on the streets. He's essentially, again, the anti-Brainerd. And he got something like 44% of the vote in the last election. He was the previous candidate for mayor. So even here, there is a tremendous division within the population as to what the preferred vision of the future is. The old middle class view, and again, remember, 40% of the community was essentially pre-1990. That group of people still, by and large, operates under the middle class mindset. They say, we like the community the way it used to be. We don't want change. We don't want all this spending. The debt's going to kill the city. And they have essentially been disenfranchised for, you know, the last 20 years because this Brainerd guy has basically been able to roll up power. Now, of course, there was divided government because the kind of middle class constituency had for a significant period of time, you know, a majority of the city council. But over time, he sort of got rolled up. And, you know, the upper middle class people have sort of been getting their way here for a very long time. Well, now there's a very good possibility the middle class people get their revenge because these 2 candidates who are running who are to be like the successors of the upper middle class point of view split the vote. It wouldn't take very much to let this Fred Glynn guy win. Now, of course, if he wins, there's also a Democrat, so it may well be that people kind of vote for Democrats because these towns are trending in a Democratic direction. And one of the reasons, I think, frankly, is this difference in the folkways. They're not as reflexively hostile to the government doing things as middle-class Republicans have been. They want to have nice stuff. And the Democrats are the party that at least claims you can have nice stuff. Now, they typically don't deliver it. They typically just shove the money in the pockets of their various constituencies. But at least they talk a good game, whereas the Republican point of view has been the government should do absolutely nothing. So if you're someone who say, hey, I'd like to have some nice parks, I'd like to have some streets that are in good shape, no potholes, really nice school, great library, then you know, your inclination, you know, is more towards the Democrats. And so that's why these have been trending purple. But this election is going to be very interesting. And it's understandable why this Fred Glynn guy and many of the old line residents of Carmel do not like the new direction, because the new direction has led to their disenfranchisement, basically. Essentially the upper middle class people came in, started promoting what? You know, a lot of dense development, all these amenities, that's drawn in more upper middle class people, which have demographically transformed the town. And now that upper middle class contingent has a demographic supermajority and is basically able to do what it wants without really paying any attention to the middle class people. So the middle class, old school, low tax, government shouldn't do anything, Republicans, you know, a lot of the people who don't have as much money as the newer residents are now, they've been totally on the outs. They haven't had any say at all in how the city has been run for a while. Now, they, again, might get their revenge in this election, but ultimately, the trends are against them demographically. As basically these people retire, they move, they die, etc. It tends to be older generation people who think this way. Of course, there are plenty of upper middle class economic people who do think this way. It's not a perfect class divide, but basically it's more the old school boomer, more middle class people who've lived here for 25 years or 40 years who don't like the new direction. And the new people coming in do like the new direction because they're attracted by the new direction. And that demographic change has shifted the population over time. And so these land use questions are not to be understood purely in terms of, I think, many of the ways that they've been traditionally interpreted. They are to be viewed, I think, as in part a result of class divisions in a fragmented society in which Americans of all stripes no longer share a common definition of the good life. They don't. And yes, there is a racial element to this as well. I'm not going to deny that there's a racial element, but there's also class elements and there's other things. And there is a perverse logic, if you will, to some of these land use policies. Again, if you are one of these middle class residents, you are going to oppose these new urbanist style high density developments that guys like Jim Brainerd wanted to build and built in abundance, because the construction of those developments will lead to your political and cultural dispossession in the city. And that has been happening to them. And then even if they win this election, it's probably ultimately going to happen over time that this is going to become a much more monolithically upper middle class community. Similarly, if you're the upper middle class people, you're like, why would I want to have affordable housing? Because if I got affordable housing that people like these old school types can move into, then they're going to come in here and they're going to undermine the public amenities that we want. We're going to import a bunch of people who are dramatically at odds with our preferences. And so the fact that these groups of people who, again, are, I'm talking about exclusively white people here, no longer share a definition, a common definition of the good life, really leads to a lot of, call it perverse incentives, to demographically shape the community in order to shape cultural preferences. Now, it's not necessarily a horrible thing if different communities embody different preferences. There's an old paper by a guy named Tiebout, T-I-E-B-O-U-T. I think that's how you pronounce the name, Tiebout. Tiebout sorting, you can look it up. It'll talk a lot about that. It's like every community, the theory here is every community should have a different basket of goods and services and price points, and then people will sort themselves into the like-minded. There'll be good market competition between them, etc. So I don't think every community needs to be the same. But nevertheless, what we have seen is greater divergence in these communities, greater segregation of people by economic class, again, because they don't share a common definition of the good life. Now, here in Carmel, what we see is that a lot of these older residents are not happy with the way things are going, but they really have, they're stuck. Where are they going to go? They have houses that have gone up enormously in value, but if they sell them, they could never move into this community. And this community has always been known for its really good schools. It has been one of the nicer communities in town. So it's like, well, do I want to move to a much less nice community? You know, to a, you know, a place in the west, the south side was totally culturally different than where I've lived? No. So they're trapped. They're basically trapped. And so they're trapped in a place where they're sort of in the process of being dispossessed, and they're probably not very happy about it. That's what I would say. And again, I think over time, things are going to change. I mean, we are very lucky that we could actually get in here. We bought one of the absolute cheapest houses left in town. And, you know, the fact is that the door is closing to people getting in who don't have a lot of money. And now actually we're trapped. Probably if, you know, if we ever wanted to sell our house, we probably couldn't afford to buy another one up here. So, we're kind of getting in at the tail end of being able to get in here. And so I think this is just one of the things that we see is these divisions that we see in society in part result from the way America has fractured and is no longer essentially a mass consumer society with a mass common culture. We have different cultures, certainly completely different cultures between the upper middle class and the middle class. And this has produced a lot of incentives for people to want to try to geographically segregate themselves in order to live a life that is aligned with their folk ways and values, and not to be people who are going to essentially undermine them. And that's true in both ways. Again, the middle class people sees correctly that many of these things that the urban crowd says you need to be doing are basically a harbinger of their dispossession. And, you know, the upper middle class people say, why would we want to bring a bunch of people in here who don't want to have a nice community? Because we would like to live in a nice community, and our definition of that is quite different. And again, even if you took race out of it, which race is certainly in it, so I'm not going to say race isn't in it, I'm not going to say politics isn't in it, I'm not going to say these other things aren't in it, but even if you remove that, these class divisions that have emerged in the last 30 years pose tremendous challenges and create a lot of perverse incentives around what to do. For the people who are poor, you see this in the city, people who live in poor neighborhoods now are like, no, please do not fix up our neighborhood. Do not renovate our park. Do not fix our sidewalks, because that means we're going to get gentrified out of here. You know what? They're not wrong. And so you got people who are like, we need to continue to have a lousy community, because if we don't live in a lousy community, rich white people are going to come in and take it over. That is not an invalid fear for them to have. And so you look at it goes from low-income minority communities all the way up to sort of rich communities. And it's even compounded by things I didn't even bring up. I just talked about the folkways. Now the fact that sort of the white middle class and lower middle class have become incredibly dysfunctional in terms of family breakdown, drug addictions, etc. You know, who wants to have that come into their town as well? So there's a lot of things going on in our society and a lot of incentive structures that militate against correcting many of the things that people like to say are problems. And so I think we need to have a little more awareness of what's going on and just understand that there are profound implications to the collapse of that mid-century common culture, mass consumer society that we have. And one of the ways it manifests itself is in land policy. So with that, I will talk to you later.